Every day we pray, at the end of our prayer, we mention that we ask God to remove the detestable idolatry from the earth, and false gods will be utterly cut off, to perfect the universe. The Malchus Shakai means through the sovereignty of the Almighty. And your gathering here today is really a sanctification of the name of Hashem, and I'm very happy to have the privilege to join with you today. I'd like to thank Jim for his very moving and inspiring talk. And I would like to speak to you from a different plane. Not that they are contradictory, but I think they're rather complementary. And it's difficult for me to comply with the Reverend's request for that 1 hour. It's really a tough one. The reason is because I usually teach Talmud. And in Talmud, you get involved in these discussions. And it's impossible to, in any way, to predict what you're going to cover and what you're not going to cover. And that becomes a way of thinking, and you just can't control it. So I'll try for brevity, perhaps. Maybe if I try to cut it shorter, you're better off than going too long. But in case I can't complete it, I believe I'm speaking Tuesday morning, right? So we'll have a last chance to complete it. I would like to discuss what I think is the most basic idea, perhaps, of the entire Torah, and the most basic point in the understanding of our relationship to God, which applies to Jew and to non-Jew as well. As you know, Maimonides calls Abraham a Ben Noach. So the concept of Israel really didn't come into play until the time that the Jews were redeemed from Egypt and Sinai. And as Jim mentioned, we do have in our tradition the concept that there are two redemptions. The first was the redemption from Egypt, and the second is the ultimate redemption, which will be redemption for the Jewish people and the entire world. All of humanity will join together in the second one. And that is part of our tradition. So this is absolutely, I can endorse what the idea that Jim mentioned from the Talmudic traditional standpoint. I would like to begin with a question. And the question is that there are seven laws of Noah. And there is one law of the Torah, of the 613. Israel has 613, the nations have seven, as you know. And one of the laws of the 613 is Avas Hashem, the love of God. Now this is a commandment, which is one of the 613. But it's not, as you know, one of the seven. And this is something which would seem to be disturbing, because after all, the love of God is the most universal concept possible in terms of religion. And in terms of our religion, how is it possible, therefore, that the Noahide system does not include this as at least one of its laws? This is the question that I'm going to base my discussion on. I will immediately mention to you that in Torah, there's a concept of an obligation and a concept of fulfillment. These are two different concepts. And Rabbi Zucker, I think, will be getting into this area a little more. But just briefly, there is no obligation for a Ben Noach to be involved in the mitzvah, in the commandment of love of God. And I will discuss why, hopefully, at the end of my talk. But I want you to know that there is a fulfillment, nevertheless, for every human being to be involved in the love of God. Abraham, as I mentioned before, was a Noahide. But the trait of Abraham that the Torah speaks about, the Torah characterizes Abraham most with, is the fact that he is the one, and the prophets as well, he is the one that brought to the world the concept of the love of God. So while I still want to answer the question as to why the Ben Noach is not obligated in this mitzvah, there is no question that the Ben Noach can fulfill this mitzvah. Fulfillment and obligation are two different ideas. You may not be obligated to do something, but you can fulfill it. And fulfillment could bring you to the highest level. And Abraham actually did fulfill this great commandment, even though it's not one of the seven laws. But I'll explain to you later why it isn't. Before I answer this question, I would just like to briefly give a differentiation between Judaism and between other religions. And I think that the passage I would base it upon most would be, for me, Jeremiah 16, 19 and 20. Verily, the Lord is my strength and my stronghold and my refuge in the day of afflictions. Nations shall come to thee from the ends of the earth and shall say, surely our fathers have inherited vanity, idols, and things in which there is no profit. The next passage says, shall a man make gods to himself, and they are no gods? The difference between the true religion, our religion, as Maimonides refers to it, and other religions, is that other religions create gods. They make their own gods. We worship the God of reality, who really exists. And as such, we are on different wavelengths. The concept of Judaism is, the most basic idea of Judaism is, that man has within himself the ability to perceive the existence of a creator. He has what is called the Tzelem Elokim. It's the divine spark which gives him the capability to see that there is a God in the universe. And this is something which can be perceived by a person. If he has nothing interfering with that part of his nature, with even without any religious instruction. And many people have been able to do this. They are rare people, and they have been great people, but they nevertheless have been able to accomplish this. Albert Einstein, the great scientist, once said, everyone who is seriously involved in the pursuit of science becomes convinced that a spirit is manifest in the laws of the universe, a spirit vastly superior to that of man, and one in the face of which we, with our modest powers, must feel humble. Albert Einstein was a scientist who studied the universe, and he was able to perceive, from his knowledge of the universe, the existence of God. Abraham did a similar thing in his day with the knowledge that he had. He was able to see that there is a God of the universe. The perception of this God comes from an element of the human mind, and it does not come from projections of the human emotions, which is the cause for other gods. That is the difference. A critical point would be, for instance, the Galileo episode, where the church persecuted Galileo for his scientific discoveries. Such a thing in our religion would be completely impossible. We would never think of dictating to God whether our planet should be the center, or whether the sun should be the center of the motions of the planets. This to us is absurdity. We don't project onto God's works. We study humbly and we appreciate his works. There has never been a conflict between knowledge of science and between Judaism. We always, on the contrary, embrace knowledge, because knowledge was given to us by God. Who is behind all the knowledge of the universe that we see? The Creator. So knowledge is never a contradiction. On the contrary, knowledge is the way in which we can approach God. So with that basis, with that differentiation, I would like to get involved a little bit in the idea of the love of God. What is really meant by the commandment that you should love God? Now, I have to just give you some material, which I would have to ask for a bit of your patience, to just go through some of the material that deals with the topic, and then we'll come to the concept. In Deuteronomy 4:4-9, we read a part of the Bible, which in Torah is the most significant in terms of our halacha, of our Torah, of our law. And here we have a chapter that we are commanded to be involved with in many ways. We are commanded to recite this chapter twice a day. We have a mezuzah on which these chapters are inscrolled. We have phylacteries where the chapter is inscrolled. And this chapter, obviously, we are being told that this chapter is of primary significance in understanding the very basic, the most basic idea of Torah. And here the statement is, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one." This means to say that there are three concepts here. The existence of God, that God relates to man, and that God is one. The oneness of God, as Maimonides points out, and I don't want to get involved in too much philosophical speculation, but the basic idea is that God is not physical, and he is not made up of any components.
Rabbi,
yes?
You quoted Deuteronomy
6:4. I'm sorry, 6, you're right. Okay. That's right. 6:4, I'm sorry. Now, after the Annunciation of "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one," you have the commandment which states, "And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul." This commandment is where the Torah formulates the idea of the love of God. Now, after that you have, the next verse says, "These words shall be upon your heart." These words are referring to the words of the Torah. "And you shall teach these words, and you shall study these words when you're in your home, when you're walking, when you're on the road, b'shachbucha, when you go to sleep, v'kumecha, when you arise," so that what the Torah is telling you is that there should be a constant involvement in Torah. That is what the passage is saying. Now, we have here the commentary of the rabbis. Rashi, on this passage, states, he says, what is meant by this love? What is this love? So he says, the question, what is this love, is answered by the next statement. In other words, why does the love of God, why is that passage followed directly by the commandment that you should be involved in the study of Torah? What is the connection between these two things? And Rashi explains, he says, the connection is because through this, the study of Torah, you will come to recognize the Holy One, blessed be He, and you will cling to His ways. Okay? Maimonides states similarly. He says, God commanded us to love Him, Maimonides says. This means that we should analyze and ponder His commandments, His words, His works, until we comprehend it and we enjoy it in its comprehension, the ultimate delight. He says, this is the love that is obligatory upon us. The source for both Maimonides and for Rashi is the words of the Sifri. The words of the Sifri in this matter are as follows. Since it says, you shall love God, I do not know how one loves God. The Torah therefore teaches us that these words which I command you shall be upon your heart. That is the study of Torah. Because through this, you will recognize the one who spoke and there was a universe. Now, it's very interesting, but this Sifri, which is the source, the rabbinical source, is something which was carried through by all the scholars in the interpretation of this chapter of the Bible. Which means that this is not argued, is not debated. This is the actual official interpretation of this passage, of the love of God. Now what's unusual about the passage is that the Sifri, which is the primary source, finds it difficult to understand the commandment. The commandment seems very simple. If you tell anyone you should love God, they immediately know what you mean, or they think they know what you mean. But the Sifri apparently found this to be not only difficult, but confusing and impossible. What was disturbing the Sifri? Why did the Sifri, why did Judaism say the oral law, the interpretation, the accepted and carried down interpretation from Sinai of the Bible, why did they find it impossible to understand what is meant by the love of God? Something which seems to be so simple to every person. The answer is because the God that we worship is different, as we said before, than any other God. Other gods are, as the prophet Jeremiah says, they are man-made gods. But we worship the one God, the true God and creator of the universe. And since that is the case, and God has no physical form, and he can't be associated with anything physical, as the Bible says, you didn't see any images on the day that the Torah was given at Sinai. Since that is the case, and not only is he not physical, he's even unknowable. We can't even understand God. It's beyond our comprehension. We can't understand his creation. We can't understand the universe that he created. How much more so can we not understand him? So the concept in Judaism is, in our religion, is that God is unknowable. This concept is spelled out in the fact that the Yud Kei Vov Kei, YHVH, is the name of God which is never read as it is written. It is written YHVH, how for me to translate, and it's read Adni, which means my master. And the tradition is that the God said to Moses, Zeh Shemi La'olam, this is my name forever, Zeh Zichru L'dor V'dor, this is my remembrance for generation and generation. Which means my name is one thing, my remembrance is something else. My name is to be written with the Yud Kei Vav Kei, YHVH. But the way I am expressed, my remembrance, the utterance, is Zeh Zichru L'dor V'dor, this is my remembrance, is Adni, my master. Why is this so? Why do we have such a strange phenomenon? It's the ineffable. We can't express, we can't mention the word of God. Only the high priest on Yom Kippur was permitted to pronounce the name of God. Why? Because the concept is to teach us that we cannot know God. If we would be free to express God's name, it would imply that we know him. And that's why, as Jim mentioned in the Bible, the glory of God is always mentioned. Why the glory of God? Because the glory of God is to teach us that God himself is something which is unknown. His glory can be known to us. We can see his greatness. We can see his great works. We can be awed by the Creator, but we don't know him. We do not know the Creator. We only know him through his works. And since this is the case, the question that is raised by the Sifri is, how can a person love a being that he doesn't know? Love commonly requires an object. A person loves something. A person loves someone. There's an object at the end of the love. How is it possible, therefore, for the Torah to give us this commandment which we can't possibly fulfill? Because we can't love God. We don't know God. God is undefinable. We can see that God exists, as Einstein mentioned. We can know he exists when we see the wonders of the universe, when we see the wonders of his laws, when we study the Torah, and we see his justice, we could see the fingerprints of God. The heavens declare the glory of God. We could see him from his works in the Torah, from the beautiful ideas that he has taught us, from his philosophy. But we cannot see him, and we cannot know him. So the question is, if he raises, this being the case, how can we love him? How can God give us a commandment that we can't possibly fulfill? So the Sefri gives us the answer. And the same answer as Rashi gives, the same answer as Maimonides gives, that there is only one way to love God. And that way is through the study of his works, through the study of his Torah, through the study of his prophets, through the study of his ideas. When we see the truth contained in his ideas, when we see the beauty of his works, when I study Talmud, I mean, last week was the first week that I got involved in an area in Talmud. It was a very difficult area. I hadn't studied it for years. And I didn't sleep at night trying to work out the concepts. But, thank God I was able to give a class. God knows I have to make a living, so he helps me out. So I was able to come to the ideas, the underlying ideas of the Talmud, and it was an ecstatic experience to see the beauty of how the whole system works, the system of the laws. And the delight, the enjoyment that one gains is of primary importance. That's of primary importance, to enjoy the beauty of God's wisdom. A person must have that appreciation. That appreciation is what is meant by the love of God. So what do we mean by the love of God? In what way is it like love? The answer is, it's like love only in one respect. When a person loves something, when a person loves someone, they have a longing, as Jim mentioned, this longing to be with that person, this longing to be with that something. In that respect only do we love God. We don't know God, but when we see his works, we have a longing, a desire to get closer to God, to be closer to this great being whose works we can appreciate, whose works by which we can be awed. That is the concept of the love of God. It's a unique concept. The love of God is not to be understood as the rest of humanity thinks, as just a shallow, empty emotion. As a matter of fact, Maimonides states that a person's love cannot exceed his knowledge. A person can't will himself to love God and just put himself in a room, bang his head against the wall, and say that he loves God. This is worthless. In order to love God, there must be knowledge. A person must have an appreciation of God's works. And it's incumbent upon us. And that's why the great scholars always not only study Torah, but they were astute students of science as well. The rabbis of the Talmud studied astronomy. Maimonides studied every topic under the sun that he could get his hands on. And from it, he was able to see and appreciate the wisdom of God. The problem with our educational system today is that the way subjects are taught are not in a way that teach a person appreciation of the love of God. As a matter of fact, I don't even think it's taught in a way that we learn appreciation of the love of science. It's taught in a way that is very mechanical, rote. It's an objective, taught with a certain objective of practicality, not of appreciation. I mean, I remember the first time I studied myself before I went to university. I used to study on my own, and I didn't have much of a secular background until later in my life. I remember how amazed I was when I heard a friend of mine tell me that he studied through the works of Plato in one course. I couldn't believe it. It took me a year to go through one of his books. But the reason is because in this society, we have to cover ground. Everything has a practical kind of meaning to it. No in-depth appreciation. This is the opposite of the study of Torah. In Torah, you can take one idea. It's more important to take one idea, understand it well, appreciate it, think about it, enjoy it, see from it the greatness of the idea. This is what Torah teaches. Not an educational system where you just go to class, take notes, make sure you pass a test, and after you get whatever degree you have achieved, there's no sense in studying any further. This is not an appreciation. This doesn't bring to a love of God. This doesn't bring to a love of knowledge. And that is really the essence of our relationship with God, is through the universe he has created and through the Torah that he has given us. This idea is a unique idea. I don't think it's found in any religion that I know of. This commandment is really what sets Torah apart. It's at the base of our whole system. So Torah, is Torah a religious system or a philosophical system? The answer is that Torah is neither. It is philosophical because it's a system of knowledge, but it's religious in the sense that it demands an appreciation, a love, and a fervor for the knowledge that it describes, for the knowledge that it gives us. It's interesting that in the tefillah, I don't know how familiar you are with the tefillos, with the prayers, but the prayer which we recite every morning has two berachot, two blessings that precede the Shema. The first blessing is Hameir La'aretz, the one who gives light to the world. And it describes the creation and describes God's kindness in creating a situation where our planet is just perfect for our existence, as none other in the universe is. And then the second blessing speaks about our appreciation and our thankfulness to God for giving us the Torah, for teaching us righteous principles, true ideas of justice and wisdom. And these two blessings are immediately before the Shema. Why? Because they are the ones that expand the ideas that we have just spoken about. That the Torah teaches man to appreciate God through the first blessing, through the universe, through the world. As Psalms 104, Baruch Yinafshi, which speaks about the beauty of the creation. And in many places in Psalms where you find out King David speaks about the order of the creation, and the whole system of the creation. Today we're finding more and more about how this system works. It says, Ruach Se'ora Osa Devar, we say in King David says, that the wind of God, Ruach Se'ora is a wild wind, does his word. And today they've discovered that the wind from the Sahara piles sand in the jungles of South America. And it's necessary. If that didn't happen, the whole system would collapse. The whole ecological system, which displays infinite wisdom of the Creator. And this is what King David speaks about. This appreciation of God's world. That's Hameir La'aretz. That's the first blessing. And the second blessing is the appreciation of God's Torah. That he gave us, all of us, the privilege to be able to take these works and guide our lives. And what could be the biggest blessing that a man can ever have than to be able to live his life properly? We know we need constantly of people who have reached what this society calls success and yet who live in total misery. And the reason is because the idea of success is a completely false notion. The true idea of success is to know how to live life properly. And that God and his kindness has given to mankind, has given to us. And this is the greatest kindness of God. I often say to people are looking for people, especially people who have troubles. And there are sometimes people who do have serious troubles. But most of the troubles that people have are the nonsense of their own imagination. And the truth of the matter is, if they would stop for a moment and realize the true good and the true kindness that God has given us, and the mere fact that we mortals, who are deserving of such a thing, he in his kindness has come down and given us a system by which we can guide our lives and have a happy existence. To return to the theme that I began with, the concept of the knowledge of God, and I say as follows. I say that a person should study as much as he can, should gain knowledge in every area that he can. Knowledge properly and you understand that it's all one knowledge of God, His universe and His Torah, you'll see that the two are complementary. And one explains the other. I mean, we say, for the question that always bothered me, how much time do I have left? Three minutes? Okay, good. So, the question that was disturbed me was, Yotzer Or, He creates the light, the Bible says, Uvor Choshech, the prophet says. And also, He creates darkness. But the question is, darkness is not a creation. Darkness is merely the absence of light. So why do we say Yotzer Or, why do we say He creates light and creates darkness? Darkness is not a creation. This is something that bothered me for years. And I'm sure it bothered scholars throughout the centuries. But with the Einsteinian revolution, we discover that space, the most basic concept of relativity is, that space is something that cannot exist without matter. As strange as it sounds to us, that is the truth, the scientific truth that relativity has uncovered. So now we understand what Isaiah meant. Yotzer means to form. He formed the light, because light is a substance. But Bo'ei Choshech created darkness, the absence, because absence could not exist. There wouldn't be a vacuum if it wasn't for the creation. So even empty space is part of God's creation. And that's why I say that the more a person studies, and the more a person understands and gains knowledge of the universe, it works hand in hand with his knowledge of the Bible and knowledge of Torah. One complements the other. And a person should try to appreciate all knowledge. Now, to return to my question, and I think this is an important point. I think Jim, before I actually conclude the question, I would just like to mention that something that Jim mentioned about the concept of the Messiah. When we speak about the Messiah, and there is a zero in society, the Gentile society, the Jewish society, almost like a messianic fever that we experience. And again here, I think we have to approach it with the fundamental basis of the entire Torah, and that is our minds, knowledge. Once a person is rocked from his mind, from his knowledge, he's in dangerous territory, because then he starts projecting all kinds of emotions onto reality. And the same is true with the concept of the Messiah, which is an important concept. But you have to have perspective. You have to understand how to approach the idea. What exactly is the concept of the Messiah? And what is the purpose of the Messiah? And why do we long for the Messiah? And Jim mentioned one aspect of the longing. My mom mentions another aspect. He mentions two, I would say, if I were to choose from what he mentioned, I would mention two points. One point he mentions is, he says, the longing for the Messiah is the reason why the scholars and the followers of Torah long for the Messiah is because they were looking for a day in which they wouldn't have difficulties, they wouldn't have a situation where they're constantly troubled, persecuted, where they have to spend their energies in trying to earn their daily livelihood and trying to avoid dangers, but that they'd be able to have a situation where they're at peace, so they can perceive the knowledge of God. As the passage that Jim mentioned, of course, the time of Messiah is when the world will be filled with the knowledge of God as the waters cover the sea, which means to say that the good, the ultimate good for man, is that man should be able to get together, just as we are here today, and discuss the ideas of the prophets, discuss the ideas of the Torah. This is the objective. There is no further objective. See, people get involved in the concept of doing good. But when they do that, they come across a strange contradiction. Because if I'm supposed to help my fellow man, you see, in order he should be able to do what? Now, in order he's going to help somebody else. And this is going to go on infinitum. But then what is the ultimate objective of all this helping? There must be some intrinsic good that we're looking for. It can't just be to help people, because once we help them, fine. Let's say everybody in the world, we could remove poverty from the world, we could remove all kinds of destructive forces from this world. Fine, what will we do then? Nothing?
Be bored.
Be bored, exactly. You see? So the concept of just doing good on an item doesn't make any sense. And many people are taken up by this, and they never sit down to think into it, to see that there's an absurdity at the end of the line. But what the Torah teaches us is, on the contrary, boredom is the farthest thing from the Torah. The purpose of all the good for mankind is so that mankind can have a situation. A situation of what? A situation in which he can study. He can reflect. He can think. He can get together with his friends and discuss ideas. To appreciate the concepts of the Torah, to appreciate the ideas, to appreciate God's knowledge. That's the objective. Ki malach ha'aretz deos Hashem. The world will be filled with the knowledge of God. That's the objective and that's the purpose. Now, Maimonides also says another interesting thing. He says, the rabbis cautioned against speculations about the Messiah and when he is going to come. It's an amazing thing. And I would say that most of the world, and I mean the practicing religious world of our faith, does not abide by that Maimonidean principle, that principle of the rabbis. I was in the home of a relative of mine, and at the time, exactly as Jim portrayed, the time of the Scud missiles, and they were talking about this with Isaiah. I hadn't heard about it. I'm not in that type of area of investigation. But I asked him to please bring Isaiah to me, and I looked into it, and a junior said, I think we were the same way, that this is just an absurd kind of attachment of a person of Isaiah to something. If they saw the word room and hide, and they said, this is it. You see? Now, Maimonides, in the name of the scholars, cautions us against this, and he states an interesting thing. He says, a person should not be preoccupied with the Messiah. Shouldn't be preoccupied with the coming of the Messiah, when he comes or how he comes. He says the truth of the matter is we will not know exactly how he comes until he comes. And he says there are many speculations about it, but he says these speculations should not become the center of one's attention. And he says because this does not lead to fear or to love of God. It doesn't lead to either fear of God or love of God. This is an amazing statement, because most people, and I'm speaking about Orthodox rabbis, they use the Messiah to give some kind of feeling, some kind of enthusiasm to their congregation. See? But Maimonides says, you're not, that's not proper. It doesn't even lead to fear of God. Let me explain to you the difference between fear of God and love of God. Fear of God means, In my mind, ideas, the ideas of Judaism, Talmudic law, fear of God is the lowest level of worship. It means a person that just keeps the laws because he's afraid of punishment. That's it. He wants to be Lord, he's afraid of punishment. Pure selfish motivation. The love of God means that a person does it because he's drawn to it. You see, he loves it, he's drawn to it naturally. Now, Maimonides says, speculating about the Messiah does not lead a person not only to love of God, it doesn't even lead to fear of God. Now, you would think, on the contrary, that if you would tell a person, you speculate in front of them, you say, well, it looks like the Messiah is going to come in another few months. You think, well, that would be great, we'll get everybody to fear God now, right? No, Maimonides says it's no good. It's no good. Why is it not good? The answer is, again, in terms of what we spoke about before, the difference between our religion and other religions is that other religions project their emotions onto reality. We humbly accept God's reality. We don't project our emotions. We put down our emotions and we accept what God has given us, even though it goes against our emotions. We accept the reality of God. Now, when a person speculates about Messiah, why do people speculate about Messiah? Maimonides says that the time of the Messiah is a wonderful time because a person can be involved in thought. He can serve God. He can be involved in ideas. He can help people. He can do things. If that's the case, people should be spending all their time, all their free time, not watching television, but studying and absorbing knowledge. And then if they don't have enough time, they'll hope for the Messiah. But you don't see this happening. People who waste, squander their time are just getting very excited about Messiah. Why are they getting excited about Messiah? The reason is, they're not getting excited about Messiah because they want the good that God has taught them. That's not why they're getting excited about Messiah. They're getting excited about Messiah because it's a fantasy. There's some kind of fantasy. Everybody has problems in life. And people, rather than solving their problems through God's law which he gave us, through the knowledge that he gave us, what do? They're waiting for somebody to come along, something magical to come along and save their lives. And that's the concept of the Messiah. You see? So it's not really a Messiah concept, it's more like a Santa Claus concept. Now my mind states that this doesn't lead either to love or to fear of God. Because fear of God is lower level as it is. The person says, I'm going to abide by God's law because I'm afraid, God, you're going to punish me. And I want to keep what you tell me because I want some kind of reward. We don't look too highly at such a person. But at least it's some kind of reality. But this is total fantasy. So that's why my mind states, he says, a person shouldn't be preoccupied. The rabbis at the time have said, a person shouldn't be preoccupied with the Messiah. Because preoccupation with the Messiah shows that the person is trying to escape reality and trying to get into some kind of fantasy. And he thinks that he's going to be gaining religiously. But he isn't. What he should do is take the words of the Torah, take the words of God, and apply them to your life and improve your life through knowledge. That's what you should be doing. And then you see that your situation is such that you haven't got enough time because of the burdens of making a livelihood and because of other burdens of society, then you should hope for the Messiah for the time when man won't have to spend his energies to such a great degree in securing his livelihood and being able to exist. But he'll have the free time in order to be able to improve his life through God's knowledge. That's what a person should be looking for. So the concept of Messiah and the messianic fever that we see in today's society is completely against the idea of the Torah. Because the idea of the Torah is on the contrary. That's why Nachmanides, when he heard the debate, and I understand you have a tape of that downstairs, when he heard that debate, he says, I don't know what this debate is about. If you ask me about whether Messiah came or didn't come, he says, I'll tell you the truth. It doesn't make any difference to me. I would be doing the same thing. What am I supposed to be doing? I'm supposed to be studying God's law, enjoying the Torah, gaining knowledge, insight into my life, insight into Torah, and I'd be doing that anyway. So what is this preoccupation with this fantasy, you see? That's the problem that we have in today's society. People rather facing their own problems and realizing that God gave them a doctrine in which they could put their life in order, are trying to escape into some magical cure. Now, to return to my original question, which was, why is it that the love of God isn't one of the seven, or perhaps the eighth, Noahai law? And the reason is as follows, that the seven laws of the Noahai code are, as we know, the most basic laws concerning humanity. Anyone that violates these laws is violating the most basic human structure, which means they cease to exist as human beings. That, if a person does not engage in the love of God, you cannot say that about him. It's true, he's missing out tremendously. He's not partaking of the greatest gift that God gave man, but you can't say he's destroying the basic concept of civilization, of human decency. That you can't say. So that's why that profound commandment doesn't belong in the Noahide system as such. Nevertheless, it does not mean that a person who is a Ben Noach cannot partake of this to the greatest degree and the Talmud mentions that openly, and that this is for him the greatest blessing and salvation to be able to do this. So that is the that explains again the concept of an obligation and a fulfillment. Abraham was only obligated at the first part of his life with 7 laws, but he fulfilled the law of love of God, and that wasn't just an ordinary fulfillment. That's why God recognized him as a special human being, and that's why God spoke to him when he was 75 years old. That means until that time he did it on his own, and then at 75 God spoke to him and gave him prophecy, and then later he gave him another commandment, but until that time he only had 7 laws. But he, what he did was, he was able to fulfill the commandment of the love of God just from the knowledge that he was able to see around him. And that was his greatness. So the love of God might not be one of the 7, but it doesn't mean that you can't partake of this. And it doesn't mean that this will raise you to the highest level of human being. Nevertheless, it is true, if a person doesn't do this, we can't condemn such a person and say, well, this person is destroying the most basic ideas of religion. He's not. He's unfortunate in that he's not attaining the highest level possible. So God, in his divine wisdom, when he created the 7 laws of Noachai, what he did was, he gave the basic system, which cannot be violated, but yet, he gave the optional, in which every human being can find his fulfillment. So he created it in a way that you should obviously do it, but yet if you don't, you're not considered a person that's destroying civilization, whereas the 7 laws that a person violates is destroying the very bedrock of human decency. Okay. Well, I want to thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to be here and share with you some of my thoughts, and I would be very happy to field some questions if you have any, whether you want to do it now or perhaps at the meetings later, and I'll be speaking again. Yes, absolutely. Yes. Okay, the question is that, and this is true, that the sages would spend a certain amount of time during the day to earn their livelihood, and the rest of the day they'd spend studying. You're absolutely right. As a matter of fact, just to give you a brief description of, and your question is, how does this apply to the Noahide? Okay. The way the sages live is different. If you say the way they'd be a bit surprised. They didn't take any money for a pulpit, for being a preacher, a rabbi. They didn't take any money for it. What they did was, they worked not more than 3 hours a day. That was the rule. And some were wealthy, if they had money, they didn't have to work. The ones that didn't, worked. And the rest of the day, they had like a communal hall, which each room they would all contribute to keep this hall open. And the main preoccupation was the thoughts of Torah. And they just get together every day and just discuss, and they just, that's where every 10-minute discussions. That was their life. That's the way they lived. Very simple, and there wasn't much to do about it. That was their preoccupation. Well, okay, you have to work another hour, so then we'll get back to the main thing in life, which is discussion, ideas, thought. Whereas in our society, the main thing is a job. People ask you, well, what are you doing now? As if, what is your essence now? You say, which is alien to the Torah way of thinking. Whatever a person does is immaterial. His essence is what's going on up here in his mind, in his thoughts. And the scholars, the sages, would work not more than 3 hours a day, and they'd have 9 hours for study. That was the basic format. And the question is, how would this apply to a Ben Noach? My answer is, the same way. The same way as it did for the sages. Because any area of human perfection is a part and a right of a Ben Noach. It's just not obligatory, but it's a right for him to reach the same perfection. So it would be no different. That advice, in other words, that formula that works for the sages would be the proper formula for us today. And the truth of the matter is that There's one interesting thing. Now, people look for signs of the Messiah, and they're always looking for these mystical kind of things. And it's interesting that what they did is they overlooked something which is realistic. But there is a realistic sign of the Messiah that we have today. I've never heard anybody mention it, but it's right there. What is it? You have any idea? So then Romania states that in the time of the Messiah, he says, the luxuries will be plentiful. So plentiful that everybody will have whatever they need. There will be no more ambition to acquire vast amounts of wealth, because people will look down upon that, since the luxuries will be like the dust of the earth, he states. He says the only ambition there will be in those days is the study knowledge of God. That would be the only thing, because anyone who doesn't, who hasn't developed himself to that point, is going to be very bored at that time. So the concept, this concept, that the world will reach such a tone, we have seen the beginning of through the advance of science. No one could have predicted, even 100 years ago, that the furtherance of human knowledge would result in the comforts and the conveniences that it did. It just happens to be that it results that way. It didn't have to be that way. And nobody could have predicted this. As a matter of fact, years ago, mathematicians and scientists were frowned upon because people were just tinkering around, didn't produce anything. Today, they're very famous because they make televisions for us. They make jets, and those were very comfortable for us. So we praise these people, you see. But the truth of the matter is, there is no way to predict it. But the fact is, as we see science progress, we see the time of the Messiah is partially here. Because of our advances in science, it makes life easier for us, so we live a much easier life than we did 100 years ago. And we have much more time. Hopefully, we will continue to advance to the point where we will be able to restrict our involvement in earning a livelihood, and spend most of our time, most of the day, in pursuing knowledge of God. That's really the purpose of life. So in a way, those people are looking for mystical signs, they've overlooked the realistic sign, which we actually see here and now today. Any other questions? Yes? That's a big question. Your question is, the answer to your question, there's two parts to the answer to your question. First of all, the question is, can we build a temple today? That's not such a simple question. There's a lot of debate, you know, in Talmud, a lot of opinions and a lot of debates, and whenever we resolve a problem, it's not so simple. There are different opinions. Some opinions are we can build a temple today. Okay. But even if we couldn't build a temple today until the Messiah comes, and there are opinions like that, it still doesn't mean to say that we're awaiting the coming of the Messiah because of the temple. See, the temple is a means. The temple, I want you to say, the mitzvahs of the Torah are a means. Adam didn't have a temple. Noah didn't have a temple. And Moses didn't need a temple. The mitzvah of the temple was given in order to instill mankind, to imbue mankind with the true ideas. But the temple is not an objective in itself. The temple is a means to teach mankind the sacrifices. Sacrifices are important. Sacrifices teach man, first of all, to be aware of his vicious instincts, of his animalistic side of his nature. If people would have known that, then perhaps the catastrophe of the Holocaust could have been averted. But many people couldn't believe it. Felix Frankfurt, when he was told what was going on in Nazi Germany, he couldn't accept it, couldn't believe it. He wasn't in touch with reality. The Torah demands that we be in touch with our emotions. Sacrifices are an important thing for us. To realize, there are few purposes in sacrifices, but that is certainly one of them. First, that you realize the bestial nature of man. We don't want to deny it. We want to realize it and avoid it, not try to fool ourselves into thinking we don't have it. And the temple has many important, teaches us many important ideas. But its objective is really one thing. love of God, knowledge of God and love of God. That is the objective of the temple. It's not an objective in itself. Okay? So that's why we say we look forward to the Messiah. We wouldn't say we look forward to the Messiah for the temple. Yes, for the temple is a means. But when Maimonides says, why do we look forward to the Messiah? It doesn't mean it's a means. I mean, what's the ultimate objective of all these means? And the ultimate objective is to be able to be strange as we're doing right now, to sit here and discuss, and to go through ideas. That is the objective of man. Okay, thank you.